Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming to what is probably the best session of the day. And I can only say for those that haven't come, they probably are not doing integrated working, because otherwise they'd be here. So a lot to talk about in terms of some really great examples this afternoon of some of the things that are happening in London and elsewhere, and quite a variety of as well, and some success stories as I understand it. Now, I think we all know today that without integrated working, there is not the possibility of providing quality in healthcare. And over the last few years, certainly patient expectations have gone up, and integrated working will be required to deliver what those patients require. Now, in previous years, and certainly in some areas I work today across London, we still see a lot of silos and an inability or an unwillingness to work with others. And there really isn't an excuse for it. And what we will show here today, I think, is that there are some people who are not using just technology to help people work in a better manner through informatics and communications, but also still the power of people, leadership, and motivation in areas such as mental health. Now, I know when I joined the organization I worked for 6 years ago, we had quite a bit of money around to do a lot of these kind of things that we only can dream of today. But over the last 2 years, it's been extremely difficult with the cost cuttings and the organizational changes around to really get any traction on a lot of the programs that we all want to do. But I'm very happy to say that we have here today some people who have shown exceptional talents in making those things happen in very difficult times. And in that respect, I'm very happy to introduce to you Lord Victor Abdulwali, who's actually the chief executive of Turning Point. Now, his expertise, as you probably all know, is in the area of managing complex needs, and his organization has become very, very well known for that. So with that, I'd like to introduce you. If the slides are working, but you're not using them. Okay.
Afternoon, everybody. No slides, you'll note. So maybe we start by putting everybody at their ease by saying that since I'm amongst friends, you can all call me Lord Victor Adebowale. I work for an I'm here actually. I don't normally do these things. It's just that I have a passion for this subject, and Turning Point. I mean, I'm hoping that it's not new. These issues aren't new to anybody in the room. It says looking hopefully around the room, and it is. I'd be concerned if there weren't people. Anybody actually in the NHS, and certainly in your professions, who wasn't concerned with integrated working. I mean, there's only two things that matter. We do realise this, don't we? Well, there are three things actually about the future of the NHS. One is integrated working, and there is personalisation. You do know this, don't you? Oh, good. There's a couple of people looking really blank and thinking, oh, Jesus Christ. Really? Is it in dispute, do you think? Because I think there might be various answers to the question how, but whether surely is a done deal, isn't it? I hope so, because if it isn't, then we're in for a world of pain, frankly. I just to sort of credentials out of the way, I'm a member of the NHS Future Forum, so I'm supposed to, I'm quite honest about, you know, why I joined and the Future Forum stuff, and perhaps if people ask me about that afterwards, that's fine. I also have been, you know, I spoke at the second reading of the Health and Social Care Bill. I've not been that too engaged in the committee stages, although I've been into committee, partly because I think that a lot of it's a done deal anyway. But let's talk about working together with complex needs. I'm going to tell you a bit about Turning Point, a bit about what we think about complete people with complex needs, a few ideas about making integration work and some examples of what we do in this regard. I should also tell you that I'm co-chair of the APPG on dual diagnosis and complex needs, which some of you may think was not what's that to do with integration. It's all about integration, isn't it? For those people, yes. So if any of you want to know more, then please contact about the APPG. You're more than welcome to attend. It's a good way of seeing the inside of the Houses of Parliament if you're interested in that kind of thing. On the other hand, you might actually be interested in dual diagnosis and complex needs, in which case you're welcome to come to the APPG and contribute. The meetings are very well attended, and we have the attention of the Secretary of State for health and social care. So, as Chief Executive Turning Point, I'm involved in an organisation that works with, well, people with complex needs, really, who live in some of the most deprived areas of the country, you know, the places that health and social care deserts, for all intents and purposes. We support about 40,000 people a year. But through our connected care work, which is relevant to this, we've engaged with about 10,000 individuals across a population of 150,000. So we work quite hard on this. And the people that we're concerned about are those with mental health conditions, learning disabilities, substance misuse, usually a combination of the above. You know, add unemployment, criminal histories, you know the personality disorder, you know them well. These people are also kind of loosely defined by having a Celtic lifestyle to boot. They have a complexity of need, comorbidity, a range of conditions, and often physical disabilities and homelessness as well. And in fact, I was just talking to my good friend Charles Fraser, who is the Chief Executive of St Mungo's, who we often talk about the lack of attention paid still to people who are homeless and or with long-term conditions. These people pose a real challenge to commissioners and providers of services across a number of agencies. And there's a moral reason for our attention to these people. There's also an economic one. They are very expensive. Have any of you come across the Million Dollar Murray story? Million Dollar Murray. Oh, there was a piece of research done. I always forget who it was by. It's probably by Harvard or somebody that showed that in America they took one person, Murray, who had been homeless. He had a mental health problem, drug problem, alcohol problem, been in and out, and they just tracked the number of services that had been engaged with him over the course of the year, and they worked out it had cost $1 million to not treat Murray. Because of the failed interactions, cross referrals, all this nonsense that just hadn't happened. Million Dollar Murray is a classic, actually. These people often cut across a number of agencies, and the reasons why they do that is because they're reluctant to engage with mainstream services, apart from anything else, not least because they often get pushed from pillar to post. You know that. They get moved from one window to the other. It's the equivalent of you going into your bank and asking to withdraw, you know, £1 million, which I know you've all got in your bank accounts, and being told to go to several different cashiers to withdraw chunks of money, each of which you've got to tell the story to. And of course, you're going to walk out, aren't you, and get the money from under your mattress. So, reluctance to engage mainstream services, there's often issues of risk of offending. The potential cost of identifying and meeting the health, social care, housing benefit and debt, education, rehabilitation needs are often seen as prohibitive. There are quite low demographic prevalence but significantly high cost. So you're not talking that hundreds of people, but they are expensive. But they're also more expensive not to deal with. And there's a workforce that lacks the required skills, required skill set to deal with the complexity of need, and the need to increase access to appropriate services, often specialist and often non-statutory services. The realisation that one agency alone cannot address the presenting issues is pretty important. I also think that increasingly public accountability and media pressure is seen as a risk that organisations won't take in dealing with complex cases in case it goes wrong, and it's it goes wrong publicly. So risk aversion, I suppose, as opposed to risk awareness, also rules these people out. I think it's fair to say, from where I'm standing, that the current system is failing people with complex needs, and it's mainly due to lack of understanding, a lack of integrated services, and a culture amongst health professionals which is at best ambiguous towards the needs of people who come under this category, this unfortunate category, and they experience exclusion, confusion, and a lack of access. And it means that their needs often escalate so that when they do present, they're more problematic and more complex than if we'd have dealt with them earlier. So it's not that integration is something which is separate from the system. I think it's integral to what we should consider to be a good system. Although people talk about the new structures, those that are set out in Health and Social Care Bill, people have approached me, at least those who think that the Health and Social Care Bill is a paragon of virtue. Hands up, all those who think it's a paragon of virtue. Interesting. They tell me that it's embedded in a desire, that it's embedded in the Health and Social Care Bill, a desire to achieve greater efficiency and collaborative working between professionals and patients, and that this the new ideas in the bill could potentially fragment, but others tell me that the new ideas in the bill could potentially fragment a system that's already lacking integration. Now, you know, I'm one of these people that oddly believe that simply putting people around a table doesn't mean that you're going to get change. So a health and wellbeing board is just a health and wellbeing board. It doesn't mean that there's going to be any difference from what went before. And the same goes for clinical commissioning groups and senates and all the rest of the paraphernalia that that people call change. There remains a fundamental gap in the ethos, action, and appropriate incentives which threaten to undermine any attempt to integrate the future health and social care system beyond its current state. Who agrees with me so far? Are you with me? One of the benefits of having a few titles is that my ego is just uninterested, really. I'm interested in the debate, but I won't fall down in a, if people get up and walk out, having had enough. There's a fundamental gap in the ethos of, and what that means fundamentally is that there's only a few of you in the room. This is the core business, in my view. It's mission critical to the success of the health and social care system, full stop, period. It's integral to good, high-quality service delivery, and there are a number of elements to this. The first is flexibility. Currently, there's a severe lack of flexible services that can offer the range of interventions necessary to these individuals. These individuals require flexible services that support the person to get on with their lives, really, with support that responds to their current needs regardless of what organisation is providing them, and that can change as their needs change. And that means they do not have to go from place to place seeking support and explain their situation to a succession of different people. So a lack of flexibility and a lack of design around the individual is at the core of this problem. Now, it seems like a simple and obvious statement, but believe me, as most of you, well, probably do know, that attempting change in settings that are embedded in clinical structures is very, very difficult. And it's difficult for a number of reasons. One is that you often discover that the patient has never been at the centre of the reasons why you've got the structure in the first place. We can talk about this at length. It's, I've got an MA in change management, if any of you are interested. So that lack of flexibility is a problem. That's not necessarily about money. It's about how you make change. It's about leadership, fundamentally. The role of commissioning is also central to breaking down barriers that continue to exist within service design and delivery. The new structures being developed, particularly health and wellbeing boards and the clinical networks, that will offer, that should offer expertise to clinical commissioning groups on specific conditions, potentially offer a way of ensuring that different commissioners are brought together to share, understand, and support the needs of a client group. But in my view, the lack of a clear definition of what commissioning is a real barrier to this actually happening. Do you understand what I mean? What is commissioning? I mean, I know some of you might have MSCs in commissioning. Indeed, Turning Point does sponsor people to go on MSCs in commissioning. I always think it's funny because when you talk to them and you say, well, you've been on the MSC, and you say, what's commissioning? And they say, well, depends on how you think about it, they'll say, you know, because of course that's what an MSC does, doesn't it? Gives you all these lists of depending on how academic they want to be, you know, and there's a, you can write depending on how you structure your thinking around commissioning. The problem with that is that when you talk to people about commissioning, they often talk about procurement or contracting or purchasing as an element of commissioning. They say, well, it's all part of the same thing. And I say, well, actually, there's a problem with that, because unless we can define commissioning clearly, we don't know actually what we're holding people accountable for. More to the point, individuals and communities don't get a service that meets their needs. So commissioning should be defined as the means by which you understand the needs of an individual and or a community such that you can build a platform for procurement. It is not the same thing, right? So sometimes people consider that commissioning, if you learn the Rolls-Royce way of procurement, you can do commissioning. I hope, you know, I know that billions of pounds have been wasted in that thinking that haven't produced services that people, particularly those with complex needs, can understand, use, and benefit from. So commissioning is critical to resolving the challenge. And the elements of any service, in my view, that's going to meet the challenge of these individuals has to be the following. I mean, you can disagree with me, but it's just years of experience, I guess. The following elements are necessary. Early intervention, which ought to be a significant contribution of good commissioning in any event. Co-production, not just necessarily by those who we might consider to be challenged by complex needs, but also the communities in which they live, which is something we often miss. Partnership working. I hate the word partnership working. It's become a meaningless term. How long have I got? About a minute. Okay. It's become a meaningless term, which often means sitting around a room and sitting around a room, really. What we should be talking about is collaborative practice, in which you are very clear about what element you are bringing to the table, and you use that as a currency to negotiate an outcome for the patient that's in the room. Partnership working is meaningless, in my view. I've seen too many examples of it not working. Pull budgets are another requirement, or some means in which the resource can be pulled and everybody's jointly severally responsible for how it's built, how it's spent, rather, which is one of the things that we're going to get, I'm told, as a result of the Health and Social Care Bill, writ large, and health and wellbeing boards and the other panoply of pull budgets. Although I think the technicians are quite good at pulling budgets together, my problem is often that it doesn't lead to change services, so you might as well not bother. Does that make sense? I don't know why I'm looking at you, but you just seemed interesting. The solutions, well, I've indicated what we might do to attack the problem. The pathway approach provides a structure so it's clear for individuals and commissioners the journey which individuals and communities need to take based on their diagnosis and other factors, other psychosocial factors. And to make this kind of these kinds of approaches work, there are a number of critical factors, and the need for information, which is shared between NHS, criminal justice, social care, and the need for integrated teams. I was once, I read a book by a chap called Muhammad J. Rasool, I think he is, on working across working across professional structures. Have any of you read it? It's a great book, actually. It's really, I mean, I read this in 2005, 6, something like that. I just think it's a really good, ahead of its time thinking about how professionals need to be trained to work with each other as opposed to just work on their own and protect them, their professional opinions from the accountability to others. I just think it's that kind of training which doesn't exist. Okay, I've run my minute out. I'll just, as I'm walking away, tell you that they give me this briefing, and they always tell me, you know, before you leave, make sure that they understand that Turning Point provides these services, so you're not talking in theory. So I should tell you that we have a number of examples of this, Milestones, which is Personality Disorder and Complex Needs Service, DHP. We are about to open our first primary care service, which will focus on health and well-being, complex needs, dual diagnosing, in Earls Court.
Yay!
Imagine how much trouble that took. And we have also Garrow House and other projects that are funded by our subsidiary Building Futures and our Somerset Substance Misuse Service, along with others, all specialise in understanding the needs of people with complex needs and dual diagnosis. And as I walk away, they wanted to fill my bag with these, but if you are interested more in technique, we have these. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Victor, for that excellent talk. I think that point about commissioning is an interesting one, not just for complex needs at the moment, because 2 years ago we started something on e-health in London where we found all those people who were involved in commissioning and then they disappeared again. And actually now re-establishing that connectivity with and finding the people who are going to do the commissioning in future is really, really important. And the second thing is if we can then find them and then I think the point about educating them as a group would be so much more efficient than going to them individually. If we could do that, it'd be great. Maybe you could provide one of the trainings as well. So it'd be a fantastic step forward if we can find out who these people are for the future. It'd be excellent. Okay, I'd like to introduce now somebody who's really got a hold of the best technology and developed new technology for really improving cost efficiencies in Northwest London and also some things there on the clinical informatics side to improve patient benefit. Now, on your notes, it says it's a pilot, but I've been assured that this is an operational system now. And what I want to know from the talk, and I bet it's not in there yet, is how he's going to spread this out across London, the UK, and really not replicate this kind of system, but actually use what's already looking pretty good. So I hope he can address that one. Thank you.
Thanks very much, David. I guess I ought to start by explaining who I am. My name's Imran Tahir. I'm a GP. I'm a GP in Kensington, so I'm kind of looking forward to working with Turning Point. You're on our patch now. I also run 11 other practices across London, actually. We've got 50,000 patients, and we specialise in turning around what we perceive and commissioners perceive as failing practices into very successful practices. I got involved with the Integrated Care Pilot as a spy for my PBC steering group. I was sent in to challenge this Imperial-led initiative, which was now going to herald the takeover of primary care. I think they did their job on me. I've now been brainwashed, and I've become one of the co-directors. But I hope to be able to now, in the next 8 or 9 minutes, inspire you and actually answer a lot of the previous speakers' questions and give you a really good example of how integrated working can actually really work. So what do we believe integrated care is? If you think of it from a patient point of view, a patient is touched by multiple providers, and this is quite a complex system, as we all know. So you could be dealing with community care, mental health care, social care, acute care, and primary care. And you could be dealing with all of these agencies at any one point. Everyone's got their own receptionists. Everyone's got their own IT system. Everyone's got their own protocols. Everyone's got their own care plans. And nobody actually knows what truly is going on in the other. So what we try to do, we've tried to pull all of this together by getting everybody to agree to two pathways. We've worked on diabetes and elderly care. And we've got primary care, community care, social care, mental health care, and acute care, which is, includes elective care, all working together. Using a single IT platform, we've got data sharing agreements, and we conduct MDG case conferences. So representatives from each of these providers are in a room talking about complex cases, and I'll go through what that means. This is where we're located. So we're spread out across five boroughs at the moment. We were initially scoped for 300,000 patients, and we're up to 510,000, and I think that's a marker of our success. We've got the whole of Kensington and Chelsea virtually, with 31 practices, 150,000 in Hammersmith and Fulham, 42,000 in Hounslow, 112,000 in Westminster, and 55,000 in Acton. Why did we focus on diabetes and elderly care? Well, with diabetes, we felt that's a relatively easy care pathway to start with. There's a lot of work that's already been done, so it was a bit of a no-brainer not to take that on board. Elderly care, we know, and as a GP, I must be one of those people that needs to apologise. We were working in our silos. We've got our QOF targets. I've got to hit my access requirements. I've got to get those blood pressures down. I've got to do my medication review. I've got to do all the yellow flags that pop up on my screen, regardless of whether what you've come in for, and I'm trying to focus on other agendas. And you often forget that actually I'm working with exceptional colleagues in a healthcare system that when I trained, I was led to believe that we would be working together. And now I think we are. So what's the big idea? Well, through a series of interventions such as patient, user and care engagement, a joint governance structure agreed at an IMB board, and aligned incentives, and that's a crucial thing to stress, I'll say it again, aligned incentives where nobody loses out, information sharing, and a development of an operational team and shared working arrangements, we have multidisciplinary groups. I've alluded to what they involve. Essentially, we have patient registers. We know who our diabetics are. Actually, I could tell you that we didn't know who our diabetics were, and that's some of the interesting work that's come out. We know who our elderly care patients are. We apply risk stratification tools on them, such as risk of admission, risk of falls. And through existing clinical protocols that are amended locally, we try and deliver care. The crux of it is having a care plan that's proactive and not reactive. So trying to do something before something happens. We conduct case conferences on a small percentage of patients identified. And this process is developing. So initially when case conferences were being conducted, we found that the cases that were coming were too easy. And as the process is going on iteratively, the case selection is improving, and I'll go through some of the feedback about that too. And crucially, we're able to evaluate performance by practice level, by MDG level, across the patch. We've also got funding secured for an external evaluation conducted by Nuffield Trust and Imperial College. So we'll be able to report back some of the learning, and we're doing that as we're going along, and also independently have it evaluated to see whether it actually works. This is a bit more detail about the breakdown of the MDGs. I think what I'll just highlight to you is that it ranges. So you've got five practices down in Hammersmith and Fulham, for example, representing 40,000 patients, up to about 75,000 in KNC North. But even the KNC North has subdivided into three smaller clusters. It can get quite complex, but this is essentially the unit of delivery. So, as I said, each MDG holds a register of patients. We apply risk stratification tools. We apply shared clinical protocols and care packages. We do a care plan, and this care plan is available to all of the MDG participants. So not just to the GPs, it's available to the district nurses, community matrons, social workers, and there are specific access permissions that you have to go through, but once you're through those, it's done. We deliver the care, we conduct case conferences, and we evaluate our performance. How does it work economically? Well, I think the bottom line that this slide says that if you say one admission per month per GP, an average GP has 2,000 patients registered on their list, then you can make this a viable project. And that's not that much. And to save an admission doesn't mean that we're not sending people to hospital. We're trying to prevent people from being admitted. Who's involved? Well, these are our providers. If you look at community health, we've got CLCH, who've been fantastic throughout the project, as have the other providers. We've also got the Mental Health Trust, CNWL, West London Mental Health. The two acutes, we initially started with Imperial and rapidly realised we can't do this without Chell West as well. And crucially, we've got the boroughs. Finally, we've managed to engage 95 GP practices, and that is an astonishing achievement. When we started out, there was absolute uproar about this whole project. We've designed an innovative IT tool. I was the co-chair of the information group, so I'm really proud of it. Also in conjunction with David Gable, who's not here, he's an acute consultant working in diabetes in Imperial College. Essentially, we risk stratify, we do care planning, we share this information, and we evaluate our performance. I keep saying the same things, but it's important to say those things. This slide's been put up to explain it's quite a complex process, and we try and manage expectations. So you can get an initial buzz of excitement. People are really interested in getting signed up. Once you've got them signed up, there's a bit of 8 to 12 week lag phase in actually going live. And that's because there's a whole series of steps to go through. But we've mapped these steps and we're happy to share them out. And this is part of the learning and part of the processes that we've managed to put in place. So as I've said, we've got 506,000 patients. So far, we've held 31 case conferences with 11 more planned this month. We have 160 care plans on the tool live at the moment. 95 practices have signed. We've extracted successfully 74 out of the 93 practices. 54 of the practices, which is over 300 GPs, have been trained in the IT tool. And we have over 300 registered users. Now, I think it's important to say we only started the project really in about August, September, would you say? Yeah, about August, September. So when you think about what we've achieved, it's phenomenal. We went live from August, September. Sorry, we did a lot of work before that, obviously, to get to where we are. Let me give an example of some of the successes. And this is a story that I kind of told at the launch event, actually. And this is a real-life case. This is exactly what's happened. So we have an 84-year-old woman with severe pain due to multiple lumbar spine compression fractures. She's on quite high-dose patches, which are opiate patches. District nurse is supposed to be applying them once a week, as well as making sure that cocodamol is being taken and Oramoth, more opiates. The GP's been desperately trying to contact the district nurse to get these patches applied correctly and has failed to do so for whatever the system failure is. The unpredictable pain results in multiple 999 calls and frequent A&E attendances. A&E are unable to do much apart from apply a new patch and send her home. GP's referred to social services and referred to physio and discussed with the acute pain team. The impact of the discussion was that alternative therapeutic agents were sought. GP was advised to inform London Ambulance of the situation through a care plan and the out of hours. We have mental health workers present, and that's one of the best aspects of this project. And there's a lot of good aspects, but mental health has really been given a real good focus in this project, and we're learning, even with our diabetic patients, for example, to really look at the mental health aspects of why people don't take medications or why they might not be coping at home. And finally, this is part of the wonderful success. The community matron stood up in the meeting and said, right, I'll sort out the district nurse situation and I'll make sure that this actually happens. So we call that stepping up, and that's exactly what we wanted to see. So some more of the feedback, it's overwhelmingly positive. I mean, as a clinician, I can tell you it's great to be able to talk to experts and your colleagues and share some of your complex cases. It benefits patients, it benefits you, you feel much better, and everybody understands the information better. These are some of the quotes. So multidisciplinary way of working has huge benefits for more joined up management and better relationships between all the professionals. This will be valuable for gathering ideas and highlighting where there are issues, glitches in the system, and will act as a foundation for more fundamental and system-wide change. Okay, I could go on more about feedback, but I won't. So, other benefits. So, as a GP, I don't even know about all of the services in my locality, and you might be surprised by that, but they change on such a frequent basis, it's impossible to keep on top of it. And one of the benefits of this pilot for these two pathways is that we've managed to map the services and have them available and everybody's understanding them better. There's an increased awareness of the scope of other professionals' roles and responsibilities. Shared learning, I've highlighted that. We've highlighted areas that might need further attention in individuals and overall population, e.g. the need for formal cognitive assessments in many of the elderly. There's been professional support and reassurance there's no more that can be done in some cases. Increased coordination collaboration with social care, and a reduction in inappropriate outpatient referrals. So the future. If I go to the future, what's next? So I think we're going to enhance our integration with the local authority. We've just about solved the IT issues we had with the local authority. They were some of the most complex issues when it came to governance and confidentiality, surprisingly, but we've managed to overcome those. We're going to continue and develop the IT tool. The evaluation is currently being conducted and we're expecting a first feedback very soon and imminently. We're scaling up the pilot, so an additional 10 practices in INWL are coming on board in the next month or so. We hope to be able to roll out to more practices in Northwest London. We hear that there might be an outer Northwest London pilot being generated, and we've been asked about that. We've got an expression of interest from Hounslow to join our integrated care pilot, and there's considerable commercial interest in our IT tool. And that's it. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for that. I have more questions than answers from that. I was just thinking about so I think we'll save those for the Q&A session because there's just so many prospects for such a tool, I think, that and things that could be added to it. So just fantastic. So I'm afraid you're going to hear from me for a little bit for now. I'm going to go a little bit further than what you've just seen there. And a lot of this is not, some of it is, but a lot of it is not available today. It's trying to look into the future at what we see in terms of the healthcare needs, and what we're trying to do as an organization today is find people to put those things together. And we're really looking at moving towards self-management more. Now, although we've got an organizational name, NHS Innovations London, we actually work around the world, and we work on most continents at the moment doing consultancy work in a variety of areas. And these are the kind of things you hear all over the world. It's not just the UK that have these issues, although you'd believe it from the BBC and so on. But in fact, everywhere has similar kinds of issues and are trying to tackle the same kinds of problems with the same kinds of solutions. And of course, we're all looking at trying to get cost out of the system as much as possible. And in the United States, probably that's where the biggest problems in that area are at the moment and not here. And so everybody's looking for efficiency and productivity gains. Everybody's really realizing that prevention is better than cures in terms of a well population. But politically, who's going to invest in that when the outcomes are very, very long term? And that was my opinion until a couple of years ago. But actually, in the United States now, you can see that even in poorer parts of society, they are doing that, although maybe it won't be a vote winner. So it's very important that we see those kind of things happening because they're very long-term, and politically, people are now starting to realize that. looking for a move more towards the from acute, which is pretty costly, as we've just seen with the system here. One of the major objectives of that is to move more and more into the community in the home, or to prevent secondary admissions through better care in those facilities and through the GPs. Facilitate, this is what I'm really interested in, facilitating self-management. How can we do that in the general population, not just with the top 2% of the population, but in any part of the population with different types of tools? And improvement of care pathways, which you've seen there, and how can we keep improving them to get better outcomes? In all of these aspects, how can we do better access, integration, and analysis of data? And what you've just seen previously, if you can't do those things, the whole thing fails, both on the patient and provider side. And then what I've put in brackets here, because I don't think these really done at all well yet, is how can we communicate information, not data, but information, to make people find it easy to respond to? And also going further than that now, and I'm amazed that these discussions have started this year in this country. I started them last year in the United States, about integrating health data with other data sources. And actually, this has been discussed recently in the House of Commons. I don't know about the House of Lords. And it's been discussed quite a lot at meetings I've had in the United States as well. So this is becoming really topical in a positive way, whereas a year ago, everyone was saying it's illegal, you can't do that. But actually, if people want it, then you can. So it's a very important part of the future of healthcare, looking at a lot of other information, not just the healthcare data. So what would be the impact if we could reduce healthcare costs, improve patient experience, improve health outcomes all at the same time? Well, if I was the government at that time, and I could do all of that, probably we'd never leave power. So what we've been looking at is actually creating what we call real-time self-management in the home, where a lot of the healthcare is the responsibility of the individual, and not of necessarily the GP or the trust or of government or a private company, but actually the individual starts doing it for himself. Of course, he needs some help to do that, but there's a lot more about the individual taking responsibility and having the facility to do that. So in terms of that, we're looking at case cost savings in healthcare, so by removing unnecessary hospital visits, just the same as the last presentation, reduction in secondary incidents by giving continuous monitoring of health in the home, giving better health outcomes rather through doing this continuously rather than a sporadic way where you have a 6-monthly visit or whatever, a better patient and carer experience as well by actually having good information and having access. And how do we do this? I mean, there's a lot of people out there at the moment who are able to write algorithms and rule-based software, but can they integrate that into clinical systems, and can we bring the right mathematicians together and the right software developers to do pretty intricate things that I'm now going to show you that haven't been done in many respects in an integrated way yet? They've been done maybe in diabetes only. And can we then communicate to the patient rather than to a clinician or a GP or a nurse what they need to do in a safe manner, and then make it real time? And one of the problems I see of a lot of these systems that we're generating at the moment in IT is they pump out lots and lots of data, and then somebody's got to deal with that data, and the more we do and the more we generate, the more difficult it's going to become. So it won't be safe and it won't be possible to deal with it, so we need tools that actually make those decisions in a safe way. Now, areas that we're looking at for this are a range of long-term conditions, cancer post-remission monitoring, end-of-life care, and of course the elderly as well. So these are areas we're looking at. What we've called post-acute recovery assurance. In other words, there are people going home and they may have a need for continuous monitoring or just sporadic monitoring, but without going to their GP or doctor, and they can do it from a home situation and transmit that data through a wireless device or whatever we intend to put in there. I'll go into more detail in a minute. Chronic disease management, there's a whole range of those. Diabetes is the first one that people are trying to address because it's the big issue. A lot of different products coming out already. End-of-life care is an interesting one in terms of the improvements that could be made there, particularly from a patient and carer point of view, which is a hugely stressful issue for people. And then, of course, with the aging population that we have and the growth in that area, more and more home care for the elderly and how to do that in a better way, in a more responsible way, but also closely connected with the growth in long-term conditions. Not a small task. So what you tend to see out there, particularly in the United States at the moment, a lot of people approach me with products, they tend to do a little piece of it. But most people who are in the aging population don't have one condition and don't need one little piece of it. They need a fully integrated solution. So what we're tending to do, and we're creating a real big problem already for the future, is we're putting lots of devices into the home to monitor patients. We're putting monitoring devices in terms of their behavior sometimes. But in the main, we're putting things in there that are medical devices to measure certain physical parameters about that. And more we will see diagnostic tools going to the home as well. So they'll have all these different devices, extremely confusing. Then lots of them pumping up lots of data to different people, and nobody will have an integrated solution, and all that data will be going to some remote site. And you'll see at the top here the number of people and individuals who could be involved in an acute clinical setting, GPs, carer, relatives, ambulance services, and so on. And what I hear all over the world is the problems that people have with, I think the generic term would be false alarms, but I would put it in a stronger term, that is actually too much data coming into that those environments. And I've already experienced in London situations where when the data's coming through, there's nobody to examine it and give a response in a timely manner. So what's the solution? You need to remove that clinical requirement and actually have something that filters that, a bit like the situation we've just seen, where there's a GP filtering whether there's somebody needing to go to an acute setting or not. You can actually take it down a lower level to certain information that these devices are generating, that if you had a computerized or automated decision-making tool, you could prevent them even having to go to the GP or to transmit the data. So what we're proposing here in terms of self-management is the ability to analyze that data in the home and then give feedback to the patient. So we've just put some simple things on here. We talked earlier before the session about dehydration being a big issue with patients going into acute settings and in the home in terms of wellness and the ability to be operated on and so on. If only we could measure something in the home and tell the people to drink a bit of water, we would save a lot of money, something as simple as that. If they were being told we have a big 50% non-compliance issue and over 65 on drugs, if we could actually find a way, and this is one of the big issues in technology at the moment, is how to make people compliant to take their drugs, because the cost savings we would make on that is actually in the billions of pounds. Telling people they need to do a particular exercise to actually solve a problem. These are really simple issues that are low risk that could be done in the home through a decision at that level without going out of the home. And of course, where the boundary is between safe and unsafe, it needs to be determined in every clinical system that's put in place. And it needs to be very clever informatics tools that make those decisions in the home, not outside of the home, and prevents the transmission of that data externally and reduces the requirement for very expensive resources. A lot of that hasn't been done yet. And a lot of the way of visualizing it is through data and not through communication tools. And let me just finish by going on to some of the things that we see that are the important things. So we've seen a talk about informatics, and there's a lot of focus on IT. It's not just about that. When we start looking at these specific requirements here, it's no point having the IT. If you look at the right-hand side here, I've highlighted new diagnostic tests. The diagnostics we need in the home to do some of these tasks are not the same as the diagnostics you would have in the hospital. So you need an integrated approach where a lot of different people are working together, not just on the IT side, but on a lot of new things as well to make those things happen. If we look at chronic disease management, again, if we're going to make improvements in those areas in the home, we need new diagnostic tests. If we look at home care for the elderly, and I've looked at a lot of these different centres across the world now, particularly in Scandinavia, where they're leading in this area, still there are problems about communicating and making the people do what you want them to do in a very simplistic way. And all sorts of tools have been forced into the home environment, but really, we need to design new things. And we've even had discussions with white goods manufacturers. So how many people, old people, still get burnt by cookers, for instance? Well, why not design a cooker that doesn't burn people and not a microwave? But there's a lot of things where we can do things in the home environment and through the construction of homes that actually helps in terms of healthcare as well. And why not do it at the beginning rather than adapting? end-of-life care, things like remote pain management. We heard about the pain situation earlier. Well, you imagine certain conditions, not just in the elderly, where you could manage pain, cognitive technologies for assessment, new devices for all sorts of things that would be incredibly helpful. But there is a real need for all sorts of new innovations, not just on the IT side, although this presentation is focused around the power of clinical informatics. And when I look at this area, and I've been working in this area for about 5 years now, and all the people that I've been involved in some of the projects we've talked about, this is just some of the groups that you have to integrate into such an activity. And I was pleased to see on the last presentation how they'd integrated between the local councils and the GPs and the acute trusts. And that's a major step forward in making this happen. You cannot believe what an effort that is. And it's down to the motivation of individuals, not technology, that allow that initially to take place. But look at all of these other things that we need. It's not just the patient and carer, all of the different aspects of the health system. That's only a minor part. You need the technology infrastructure providers to participate. You need mathematicians, and there aren't many of those out there that can then work with the software developers on these kind of things, because this is pretty sophisticated stuff. The companies are completely disparate, and there has been some attempts at joint ventures recently, but they're not terribly compatible. You know, Intel and GE on a project. It's incredibly difficult to implement those things. They're trying, thank goodness, but it's very difficult. And these diagnostics companies are very different to devices, are very different to IT, and are certainly different to white goods companies. It's got to be safety issues, and so there need to be new safety standards that are not restrictive. You know, these companies have still got to have the room to produce their products, but in a safe manner. System integration is important. We don't have the right kind of system integration to put these into the places at the moment, and suppliers. We don't have construction companies that are thinking about these. There are a few, but not many. And in terms of the data sets that need integrating, this is a lot about not just healthcare providers, but retailers and financial people who can support this. So I know London Councils have done a lot on that already. So there's a lot of different people involved. So this is truly integrated working to make this happen. And commissioners, believe it or not, could play a major role in this if they were educated in the right way and had the motivation to do it, because they're key to success, I think. But it, as I put at the bottom there, it's not just about clever health informatics. If all the rest isn't in place, the informatics won't count. My last slide. I just found these in the press, and I thought they were interesting in terms of people thinking, oh, it's not possible to do that today. You know, we'll never do those things. But I just found these headlines. One, the first one's in the Daily Mail from February this year. Star Trek scanner measures damage to your body from smoking and junk food. I tell you, a year ago I had a guy come from a hospital and then tell me that he had a device for doing what Dr. Spock did in Star Trek. And all my people just went, you've got to be joking. But actually, you know, somebody's doing part of that right now. And then this one here in the San Francisco Chronicle in May, they announced the world's first portable brain sensing system for stroke. So these things that are coming through in terms of technology now are making things possible that we would never have dreamt of 10 years ago. And you see there Star Trek IV bloodless surgery. Well, think of all the non-invasive techniques we have at the moment, and where is that going to go? A lot of the real cost savings and health benefits we see at a real acute level now are through non-invasive techniques. We've not got to that level yet, but how far away is it? Anyway, thank you very much.
Shared business services.
And what I'm interested in on this as well is where it goes next in terms of the integration above to the clinical layer as well.
Absolutely.
Because it should be a benefit there.
Great. So yes, good afternoon and welcome everybody. So I think we have a different angle on the discussion this afternoon. Obviously, what we've been talking about before has been very heavily clinically orientated integration thereof. What I'd like to do this afternoon, I'll be supported by Sally Gorham, who until recently was the Chief Executive of Waltham Forest Primary Care Trust. What we're going to talk about this afternoon is the integration of business support services or back office services with the clinical activity, which in my mind at least is equally important in terms of enabling the clinical activity to focus on what it really should be directed at, and not taking up time worrying about back office support activity. So in that context, if I press the right button, I just very, very briefly wanted to introduce NHS Shared Business Services to you. Until about 25 minutes ago, we were the country's most successful example of a public-private partnership. We're now a public-private collaboration, I believe, is now what I need to be. And we're an organisation, a joint venture company that was formed back in 2005, bringing together expertise and capability, particularly around finance and accounting from the NHS, joined up with a company called Steria, who's an IT and business process outsourcing organisation that's formed this joint venture organisation. We have a mission to deliver over £200 million worth of savings into the NHS by 2014. In terms of the range of activities that we're involved in, we provide our services to around about 45% of trusts across England. And main activity is around finance and accounting support services, where we're processing over £41 billion of payments every year. We're paying or processing about 2.5 million payslips per year. We're the largest provider of family health services, and we are, from a purchasing point of view, delivering savings on an ongoing basis, and are procuring large quantities of activities for 50 different trusts across England. In terms of the focus of our activity, very much around improving quality of service. We absolutely recognise that we don't get it right all the time, but we are investing in, and I think this is particularly important related to the message of integration, of how do we continuously improve what it is we do as an organisation. The Hackett benchmarking activity is a global benchmark. We've been assessed for the last 2 years as being in the world-class quadrant. What we need to do is continue tailoring that approach so it is very much localised, that we're addressing not just the needs of our immediate customers but those of our customers' customers, for example the GP community. So with that brief introduction, I'm going to hand over to Sally.
Thank you, John. I'm going to just run through very quickly about how SBS is supporting, just in one place in London, but it's doing it in other places as well, clinical commissioning through providing shared business services. I became involved with NHS SBS when I led a pilot project to outsource family health service in out of North East London, and have continued that relationship since I left the NHS. I think, firstly, just to say that I think some of the leading clinical commissioning groups and certainly clusters are recognising already that to be excellent, they're not going to be able to do everything themselves, and certainly not trying to aspire to do everything in-house, and they need to be working in partnership. Clinical commissioning groups that are focusing their energies on, as we've heard this afternoon in Northwest London, their energies on using their clinical knowledge to reshape services are already starting to deliver some improvements. And the example I'm going to give is from out of Northeast London, but we can see that in many different places. NHS SBS, as you've heard from John, is an at scale because it's providing some services across the country. Transactional support service that can already demonstrate that it's delivering effective support to clinical commissioning groups and clusters, and has aspirations to be able to do more. So the sorts of things that NHS SBS can do. At one end, it's supporting GP registration around the FHS package of services that it offers, ensuring that lists are clean, which is absolutely essential to have a validated list if you're going to have clinical registers. Processing payments to GPs, whether that's QOF payments or whether that's optometry payments, pharmacy payments, or locally enhanced schemes. It's enabling new solutions where PCTs, clusters, and trusts are purchasing their procurement solution, although in the example I'm going to give in out of North East London, they're not currently taking that that solution at the moment. Payment to new providers being processed, payment to existing providers, whether they're trusts or foundation trusts, and then providing some benchmarking data back to those organisations to monitor and evaluate, obviously essential. So just I'm going to just concentrate on three examples very briefly. We've heard a lot about the diabetes model and also one around vulnerable adults in some depth from a clinical perspective, but I just wanted to talk about how having an outsourced back office provider with integrating with local clinical commissioning support can enhance the whole pathway. So these are three that my colleagues who continue to work in Waltham Forest have very kindly agreed that I can share with you. So they're being supported by Outer North East London Cluster, but it's the Waltham Forest Pathfinder group there of clinical commissioners who are taking the work forward now on diabetes, ophthalmology and vulnerable adults. So the priority in Waltham Forest has always been to have clinically led development of new and more effective pathways to improve the patient experience. They've always worked together as a group in a very tight-knit way. They're now a federated group in Waltham Forest and achieved early Pathfinder status. Outer North East London Cluster recognised very early on the need to work very closely with their clinical commissioning groups to try and develop a really tailored, effective commissioning support service. And the cluster has a track record of delivering significant savings through implementing a variety of shared back office services at scale, finance and accounting through SBS, but also, as I mentioned, piloting the first place in the country to pilot the FHS back office service. So in their four-tier diabetes pathway, some of which was developed last year and some of which has gone on to be developed this year, they've developed a model using the London model of four tiers of a tier one and two in primary care, obviously payments through QAF there, but also supported by a locally enhanced scheme using the NHS London exemplar format going live in January. And practices there being accredited against a particular criteria set within the locally enhanced scheme. A tier three community specialist service, sounding quite similar, I think, to some of the description in North West London, although not entirely the same. This was procured and commissioned under the leadership of the GPs in Waltham Forest the year before, and there's plans to potentially expand that service. And then the tier four service being provided with the acute provider, who in this case is Whipps Cross University Hospital. Plans for activity are 1,000 follow-up appointments to be managed in the primary care tiers one and two, which would have previously gone into Whipps Cross Hospital, being paid for under PBR, or into the community specialist service. So the way in which NHS SBS comes into play in this is supporting the GP payment side of this pathway, contracts payments to the community specialist service and to the tier four provider as well. On the ophthalmology pathway, just two conditions here, although GPs there have aspirations to have many more condition-specific pathways for ophthalmology, but the two just focusing on here, firstly around glaucoma, this example referral by GP into a triage service. This triage service is actually provided by Whipps Cross Hospital, but then appropriate first outpatient and follow-ups referred to an independent community specialist service. This service is interesting. It's provided by optometrists, but with consultant oversight. The consultant is actually a consultant who works for Whipps Cross Hospital, but when he's working in this independent service, he's not working for the hospital. He's working for this group of optometrists who have come together and won a contract for providing this service. So it's quite a complicated package, but you can see how working together, primary care clinicians working with secondary care clinicians with local optometrists have come to be able to put together a pathway that's working for patients. The GOS 18 service, this is taking a number of conditions which optometrists are referring into hospital on a form which is known as GOS 18, which is how it gets its name for those people who aren't familiar with that. That's ready to start in January time. Whipps Cross here are going to be providing a triage service, but in this case, instead of the GPs themselves commissioning the service through the cluster, that Whipps Cross Hospital is subcontracting with optometrists to take those referrals. So again, an example of primary care clinicians working with optometrists, community-based optometrists and an acute hospital to provide a pathway for the benefit of patients. As I say, the aspirations as well to provide other pathways as well, but those are still under construction. Again, aspirations to move 1,000 plus outpatient follow-up appointments into a community setting. Here, again, supported by NHSBS, SBS, with initial site payments to opticians managed by NHS SBS, where they're paid for under the NHS, contract payments to the community specialist service and into the local trust. Integrated care management for vulnerable adults, again, are quite similar to Northwest London here, using predictive modelling tool, this time packaged by Health Analytics, matched with GP knowledge. Again, building on the Torbay model here, integrated care liaison officers to really provide really bespoke services around more vulnerable adults. Again, big aspirations in terms of shifting care out in the community, preventing admissions, again, similar to Northwest London and what other people have spoken about. And again, supported by NHS SBS in terms of payments to practices, contract payments to Whipps Cross Hospital, and in this case, to North East London Foundation Trust, who are the provider of community matrons. I would have very much liked to have had one of my colleagues from Waltham Forest here to be able to talk to you, but the chair of that group, given that they're such leading lights, is actually speaking at one of the other sessions, which is why I've been covering this myself. But I really want to make sure that there is sufficient credit to that group. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah. We'll have a short panel session where you can ask questions and maybe have a little bit of discussion. Complex issues.
I'm just back up for a moment. Sorry, I should have introduced Scott Hamilton. He's the operations director for the ICP.
Okay, we have 10 minutes, maybe, isn't it? Five minutes. Okay. Any questions? Yes.
So the answer is absolutely yes, and we're already liaising with the head of medicines management. One of the screens, there's actually four or five major screens in the IT tool, is about medicines.
Yes.
And it actually brings together the prescriptions from secondary care and primary care onto one page, which is really interesting. Consultants think patients are taking one medication and GPs are prescribing another. So we've definitely got the pharmacy input from the medicines management teams, and there will be a plan in the future to roll it out to pharmacies to have access to it.
I was also thinking about face-to-face clinical medication reviews.
So that's part of the pilot at the moment, but not with pharmacists. That'll be a future development.
Actually, two of our MDGs have made a request that for the MDG case conferences that we use some of our out-of-hospital resource funding, that each MDG has a pot of money to use, that they want to use that to pay for a community or acute pharmacists to attend the MDG case conferences to be part of that face-to-face multidisciplinary group. And so that's something that we'll be having in the next couple of weeks. One of the things that's a bit of a challenge on the IT tool is looking the community pharmacists up and figuring out the user access onto the N3 network, in order to give them access to the patients and figuring out which ones they'll get to see. But it's absolutely one of the main themes.
I mean, some of the work that's being done by the Royal Pharmaceutical Society is where they're looking at workforce development, having an infrastructure to support the community pharmacists, and that's where they're looking at the role of the consultant pharmacists. I just thought I'd throw that into the middle.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes.
My name is Samara, I'm from Public Health in the Northwest London. I just wanted to ask about migration into the home and having an IT system that supports that. Just in terms of that, we work with quite a lot of isolated people who actually kind of value the interaction.
Yes.
Whether there's also work with a lot of people who have low-level literacy and even lower level of health literacy, less low kind of IT support. I'm just wondering, in terms of these systems, what supports are there available? And are there any potentials for working with communities? We have a community champions project that works on peer education support for actually promoting access to these services.
The biggest project in this country, I think, is up at Aberdeen, Aberdeen University, that's funded by the UK government. They're doing a lot of work on remote access to these kind of individuals. I think up until now, it's been fine for individuals who can use technology. And certainly there's an ability to reach out to those people with all sorts of systems. And I know that some US companies are now providing lower cost technology to do that. I think there still isn't a solution for other parts of the society as I see at the moment. I haven't seen a solution unless somebody else from the panel is aware of those. But
well, I mean, we've moved from talking about people, talking about technology really quick, haven't we? I mean, I don't know what role things like video conferencing plays in this, but I recognise the patients, the people that you're talking about, and you can subdivide them even further into those that are familiar with some technologies as opposed to others. But I would argue that what people want at that level is technology that allows them to give is kind of a surrogate face-to-face meeting, which I would have thought is the kind of...
That's right. The sort of Cisco telepresence things at a lower cost level of things that people are using. But I know that some of the TV companies as well have been doing a lot of research around, because they found a lot of people are happy with a Sky controller or whatever, about using those kind of things for interactions as well, over the television. So there is work being done, but it's not a solution you can buy off the shelf at the moment for that sort of thing.
Well, I should just say, I'm actually involved in a company called IACOM that actually does provide the West London Cancer Network and using that kind of stuff. And the Stroke Network, it is available. I mean, and people do use it in their own homes. One button. Yeah.
But it's not interactive, is it?
Well, it can be, yeah, the Stroke Network.
But I mean,
what do you mean by interactive?
Yeah, on terms of personal interaction, is it?
Depends what you mean by.
Well, that's also the other tool, of course. Depends on the level you're dealing.
Talking to someone's interactive, then it's interactive. And displaying data about your blood pressure and all that it'll do that.
Depends what you're trying to achieve. Yes.
I was interested with the West London part in particular. I'm from the Claremont from OGK. I'm just vulnerable elderly population who have got of this stratification system. And our experience is that a lot of the reason that more people get admitted to hospital and have unless admission is almost before that stage, and it's the need for informal, practical and emotional support, loneliness and isolation, and all of those sort of. So I think my question would be, how can we incorporate that element of the low-level support that falls outside statutory and clinical provision?
You'll be really pleased to know that you're one of the actual members on the board and you've provided input into the clinical pathway development.
Good.
I've forgotten the name of the chap, Ben.
I think it's Westminster. I know it's our local agent.
Ben Cavini he's one of the voting members.
Probably be Westminster for
Westminster
UK, and I come from the national.
Yeah, but
so I think he's one of the chairs within London for HUK. He sits. He has voting rights on the IMB. Sits in all of our committees.
Right.
Works with us on what we need to consider. Has also been a great sounding board in making sure that providers and organisations don't get sidetracked into their siloed objectives and bring it back to the patient as what we need to be focusing on, and is also the chair of our patient and user group, which is working with us to build the patient portal and make sure we take into consideration all of that stuff.
Well, that's a result then.
It's a great question.
Patient, user, and care group. So Diabetes UK and HUK are both voting members.
Okay. Yes.
I'm the lead scientist for NHS London. I'm really interested in the driver around new diagnostic tests, and wonder how you see the pull diagnostic tests in a different way, for example, in the community? Because we're not doing it now,
no, no.
Although we have diagnostic tests that could be used. So I was just wondering how you see that.
So if we take the oncology situation, it may be that you're looking for a marker in the home environment that is very, very different to one where you're doing a fully fledged diagnosis in a hospital during the diagnosis of the disease and then the monitoring of the treatment. And so post-mortem, it could be a completely different diagnostic, and it would have to be much simpler to use than what we would have clearly in a laboratory environment. So it may not just be the conversion of the lab diagnostic into the home when it may be a completely different biological marker or something like that.
Which obviously is aspirational. I think I just have concerns that we've got markers now that could be used in a different way in the community.
Yes.
You know, very simple things around using technology, PHBA, we'll see
monitoring. Yeah.
That we're just not doing now.
That's absolutely true.
Really interesting how we can get
Some of the slight tongue-in-cheek in my presentation was that there are a lot of patients out there that are diabetic that we don't know are diabetic, and we're finding that out because we've got the results.
Yeah.
But not the codes for diabetes, and vice versa. So that's going to be an interesting development as this project goes on. And it's not just isolated to us. There are lots of research papers which support some of our findings.
Yeah.
And I think the transparency agenda, which is another talk going on right now, actually in another room, is going to address some of that. But we do that as well with our peer review and our peer evaluation, etc., and naming. And showing people, actually, did you know that this percentage of your patients might be diabetic, for example, and what are you doing? And this practice has got so many patients above an HbA1c target, yet down the road, they're all at target. What's going on in yours and what's not going on, et cetera?
Which actually links back to what you're saying, because that's patient self-management as well.
Yeah.
Diagnostics for the patient to be able to say, my HbA1c is drifting up, perhaps we need to do something, need to be at an early stage.
So our patient portal will hopefully, sorry, you want to say
no, that,
but our patient portal will give you access to your own readings and an explanation to that and hopefully a timeline to it too.
I think there's two different things there. I mean, there's also a regulatory aspect where, you know, we've got particularly a marker now for identifying a heart attack at a very early stage. But, you know, you could migrate that particular marker into point of care kind of diagnostic as one stage, and then maybe you could actually put it into an OTC test that you can buy in Tesco's. You know, you could have it in your kit bag when you're playing squash. If you get a chest pain, you could test yourself. But the whole regulatory pathway to get there probably will take 10 years, and also a lot of large clinical trials to validate that. The other thing is that particularly on diagnostics now, we're aware this year of two new screens for the GP's office, which are very reliable, using completely new technology that are non-invasive, non-biological, that are external to the body, that are very, very cheap. But actually, to get those validated within the system, to get a reimbursement, will probably take 3 to 5 years, and to get it accepted. So I think there are new things coming through. They're going to move healthcare out of that expensive environment into a lower cost environment, nearer to the community. But it will just take time because of the safety and validation issues. Anybody else? Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.